want to start today by wrapping up some features of homeostasis we didn't get to last time. And the first thing I want to mention is about something I said about handout 28. This is very brief. If you don't have it right with you, you probably don't need it. We drew this regular circuit picture, and we said that what goes along the arrows can be either hormonal or neuronal. Now, in truth, there are only two arrows here which involve signals, and those are the afferent and efferent ones into and out of the integrative center. These involve signals which are sent from the sensor to the integrative center and from the integrative center to the effector, and those signals can be either hormonal or neuronal. But the two top arrows don't represent signaling. They represent the influence of the level of the variable involved. And I want to thank the student who pointed this out to me last time. Now, what we said when we drew that circuit is that, and when we drew the very first circuit for regulation of blood glucose, is we said there are effectors here, and they either suck up glucose from the blood or release glucose into the blood, but we weren't going to explain why or how it worked until later. And what I want to do today is unpack that black box just a little bit. How do the respective effectors either reduce the level of sugar in the blood or raise the level of sugar in the blood? And this comes down to the question of how does insulin work? How does glucagon work? And these details, if you're interested, are in the notes from last time. I did not reprint them. Now, I think the easiest way to do this is to compare the two of them. Insulin and glucagon. And maybe we should say right off, what are their effectors? Insulin, you may remember, is responsible for glucose uptake from the blood. So the big effect is glucose uptake into the effectors, so that the glucose level in the blood falls. While glucagon has the opposite effect, it causes glucose release by the appropriate tissue, and as a result, the glucose in the blood rises. But what are the effector organs that actually pick up or release glucose? Now, it turns out that glucagon has really only one major effector, and that's liver. And we'll see why that is in a bit. On the other hand, insulin affects three major tissues, not only the liver. Now, notice the liver is in both places, meaning that the liver can either take glucose up or release glucose. People think of the liver as acting sort of as a reservoir and acting as a buffer. It contains glucose in polymerized form as glycogen, and it can either release it or it can slurp it up and convert the glucose into glycogen. So it acts as a buffer and a reserve. But in addition, muscle and adipose tissue also respond to insulin. All three. However, these three don't all respond in the same way. Now, before we go any further, these two hormones have to bind to a receptor and trigger a result. And both of these hormones are proteins. So that means they're water soluble. So where is their receptor? It's going to be on the surface of the cell. It's going to be on the membrane, on the plasma membrane, in both cases. The insulin receptor and the glucagon receptor are both surface receptors. But they are totally different proteins, and they work in totally different ways. The glucagon receptor is a G-protein-coupled receptor. Which works by increasing the supply of cyclic AMP and activating PKA. So we know how this works. It means that glucagon binds to its receptor, that activates a G protein, that activates adenyl cyclase, that produces cyclic AMP, that binds to PKA and activates it, and then PKA phosphorylates the appropriate targets. On the other hand, the insulin receptor is quite different. Most hormones use G protein coupled receptors, but insulin does not. Insulin uses a tyrosine kinase linked receptor. We haven't really talked about how these work, and we may get to it at the end of the class. The insulin receptor is quite different from almost all other receptors of hormones. It's more like a growth factor receptor. And for now, we're going to leave off how this works. But the point is, when this receptor binds its ligand and changes configuration, the events inside the cell, the chain of events, leads to changes in enzyme state by a different method than using cyclic AMP, and we may or may not get to the details. It turns out that this receptor has an extremely complicated signaling pathway, and that's one of the reasons for leaving it out. But when you then activate the appropriate proteins, what proteins do you activate or inhibit, and what do they do? So one way of looking at this is to ask, what are the events that are influenced by these hormones? And it's easier to write it separately for the two of them, even though it's pretty much the same events, but in the opposite directions. So what gives with, if we consider insulin first, insulin promotes glucose uptake. So that means if you have glucose outside the cell, it increases the rate at which glucose enters the cell. And then, before anything can happen, the glucose has to be phosphorylated. Now, what happens to glucose once you phosphorylate it?
It's stuck in the cell.
What did you say?
It's stuck in the cell.
Well, it's stuck in the cell. That's a good point. It can't get back out because the transporters here, which are GLUT transporters, will not move phosphorylated glucose. They'll only move glucose. Second of all, if you have a glucose transporter of the GLUT family, what drives the movement of glucose? It's going down its concentration gradient. So that means that as you phosphorylate glucose, you reduce the level of glucose inside, thereby increasing the concentration difference, therefore driving more glucose in. So controlling the second step is important too. But now, once you've got your glucose phosphorylated, what's going to happen to it? What do cells do with glucose? Do they break it down? Well, that's one possibility. If they need energy, they break the glucose down to smaller stuff, such as lactate, CO2, etc., and they get energy. But what if they have extra glucose? Glycogen. If this is a liver cell or a muscle cell, it makes glycogen. If this is a fat cell, it would convert the carbon structure to parts of the fat and store fat. But since this is largely liver that we're talking about, or muscle, skeletal muscle, it's converted to glycogen, which you may remember is just a polymer of glucose, 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 glucose. But in general, you get the storage form of glucose, fat or glycogen, and people refer to that as store. So either you can build the glucose up into a storage form, or you can break it down for energy. But either way, the amount of glucose lying around, or glucose phosphate, is going to be minimal. Now, what insulin does, either directly or indirectly, is basically to stimulate some or all of this. And exactly how it does it is different in the various tissues. Now, we've already said earlier, when we were talking about transport, that in muscle and adipose tissue, the glucose transporter, that's used to get the glucose in down its gradient is GLUT4. And in liver, it's GLUT2. Now, why is this trivial difference, apparently trivial difference, so important? GLUT2 is constitutively in the membrane. So liver has a transporter all the time. And whether glucose is taken up depends largely on the gradient here between the glucose outside and the glucose inside. Now, insulin stimulates glucose uptake in liver. But the transporter is already there. So how does insulin stimulate glucose uptake in liver? It's not step one. Step one is the same. What it does is insulin stimulates phosphorylation of the glucose once it gets inside. And that increases the gradient and pulls the glucose in. Insulin also stimulates both the storage of glucose in other forms and its breakdown. So in liver, insulin increases the usage of the glucose and the phosphorylation of the glucose, thereby indirectly causing its uptake. But in muscle and adipose tissue, insulin has a direct effect on uptake. Because remember, GLUT4 is not constitutively in the membrane. GLUT4 resides, when no action is needed, in vesicles. In response to insulin, the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane. There is exocytosis. And as a result, the transporter ends up in the membrane. And now, glucose can be taken in, courtesy of GLUT4. So people say that insulin mobilizes the GLUT4 transporter. So without insulin, muscle and adipose tissue cannot take up glucose. Now, resting muscle cannot. It turns out that exercise also mobilizes GLUT4, which is another good reason to exercise. Okay. Now, in muscle and adipose tissue, insulin also stimulates using up the glucose, but its really critical effect is in mobilizing GLUT4. Other hormones can do most of the other things that insulin does, but no other hormone can mobilize GLUT4. And that's why a lack of insulin or a lack of response to insulin is so serious. As we mentioned last time, diabetes type 1 is due to a lack of insulin production, and diabetes type 2 is due to a lack of response to insulin. Okay, so that pretty much says it for insulin. How does glucagon have essentially the opposite effect? So to make that clear, I'm going to write it again. The same sort of setup. Glucose out, glucose in, glucose phosphate, stores, and small stuff. But the difference is that glucagon stimulates the release of glucose only from liver. Now, why doesn't it affect muscle or adipose? It's a very simple reason. There are no receptors for glucagon on liver, on muscle and adipose. But it wouldn't matter because muscle and adipose cannot release glucose anyway. To release glucose from the cell, you have to do something important. The glucose in a cell is not loose, it's glucose phosphate. So if you're going to release glucose from the cell, you have to reverse the first two steps we had before. You used a kinase and ATP to get phosphate onto the glucose. To get the glucose off, phosphate off, you have to use a phosphatase. And that phosphatase is found only in liver and perhaps a little in kidney. But it's not found in muscle, and it's not found in adipose tissue. So what glucagon does is to stimulate the cells breaking down the storage forms of glucose to make glucose phosphate, putting small things back together again, if necessary, to make more glucose phosphate, and then using the phosphatase to take the glucose and the phosphate apart. So now you have free glucose in the cell, and it can go out. So this is what glucagon stimulates. Now, there's just one other piece of information or terminology we should add here, that I've drawn these, the two pathways, those stimulated by insulin and those stimulated by glucagon, just as the opposite. They aren't exactly the opposite. Many of the steps in breaking glycogen down to glucose phosphate are similar to the steps in making glucose phosphate to glycogen. But some of the steps are different, use different enzymes in order to couple the whole thing to ATP breakdown and to get the energy to drive these processes in the desired direction. Similarly, the process for breaking down glucose phosphate to small things is not quite the same as the process to rebuild the small things back into glucose. There is no perpetual motion machine here. You have to put some energy in to put the small things back into glucose. So you use some but not all of the same steps, and this process is called gluconeogenesis. And it is stimulated by glucagon in the liver, and if you're interested in the exact steps, you can look it up in your textbooks. Now, the way insulin works is complicated molecularly, but the way glucagon works is that it stimulates, remember, pKa, which then phosphorylates the appropriate enzymes to stimulate breakdown of glycogen and buildup of glucose by gluconeogenesis and phosphatase so that glucose can be released. Now, we've talked about insulin and glucagon as being in charge of glucose homeostasis, of being in charge of keeping the blood sugar level more or less constant. You have to do that because your brain depends on glucose. Your brain can take up glucose anytime, but it has to be there. And so in order for you to operate maximally, you have to have glucose in the blood about the same all the time. But you can broaden this idea that these hormones are in charge of something else as well. Normally, people eat episodically. A few people nibble all day, especially under times of stress. But most of us eat more or less regular meals. So that means that the input into your blood of nutrients is not constant all the time. It's very high after a meal and relatively low in between. And so you can look at these two hormones as being in charge of handling an episodic event, which is one of the things that hormones do. In addition to maintaining homeostasis, they manage episodic events. Like, for example, birth. Or, less dramatically, eating. So if you think about the conditions relative to eating, just after you've eaten, you have high levels of glucose, amino acids, etc. in your blood. And that's called the absorptive state. Because at this point, what you want to do is take all that stuff out of your blood, get it into the right tissue, and either store it or use it. On the other hand, and the risk here is high blood glucose, low blood glucose. Here, the risk is high, of high also amino acids, high other stuff. And so you have to clear out the blood. That's the problem. So absorption is the big deal. But in between meals or when you're fasting, then that's called the post-absorptive state. And now the problem is not that the sugar might get too high, but the sugar might get too low. Because what you have to do now is from your stores, you have to gradually release little bits into the blood to keep the blood level, the glucose level in your blood the same, and to keep your brain working. So you can also think of these two hormones as controlling the absorptive and the post-absorptive state. The absorptive state is largely determined by the presence of insulin, and the post-absorptive by the absence of insulin and the presence of glucagon. And it's probably the absence of insulin that's so important. You've all heard of diabetes, but I don't think any of you have ever heard of a disease caused by the absence of glucagon. And that's because you can manage without it. Other hormones can cover for some of its effects, and some of the other effects aren't so important. But the absence of insulin in the post-absorptive state is very important. And one of the reasons for that is that insulin, in addition to activating all this stuff, inhibits some of the things activated by glucagon. Now, I want to summarize up this response to these hormones, but let me ask first if there are questions before we go on here. Yeah?
How does, when you take glucose from the liver, does it leave via the GLUT2, or how does it leave?
When glucose leaves the liver, does it leave versus GLUT2? Well, if you have a GLUT transporter, can it move glucose in either direction? And the answer is yes, it just depends on the concentration. So the same transporter can be used to take glucose in or glucose out. Now, in muscle and adipose, why don't you use it to take glucose out? There isn't any glucose lying around. All the glucose that's around is phosphorylated. It's only in liver that you can take the phosphate off the glucose and have it ready to release. Yes?
So bad about high blood sugar.
What's so bad about high blood sugar is that it triggers all kinds of things. It can mess up your kidneys because they can be overloaded trying to recover the sugar in your blood, which they normally do. It can glycosylate. The question is, what's wrong with high blood sugar? You can glycosylate many proteins in your blood, which apparently messes them up. It can cause glaucoma, I believe, in your eyes. And I'm sure there's more, but that's the minimum. But neither very high nor very low blood pressure is good for you. They just had an article in the Times, I think yesterday, that very low blood, severe incidence of very low blood pressure are correlated with dementia. So that, if you're a diabetic, you shouldn't overdo it. Okay. Now, I want to summarize, wrap this part up by asking, or by looking at a very important issue. In order for regulation and to work, and for an organism, a multicellular organism, to function properly, you have to get the right response out of the right tissue in response to a signal. Whether the signal is a neurotransmitter, or a hormone, or a growth factor, an awful lot of what goes on depends on eliciting the right response from the right cell type. And how is that done? We've actually discussed many cases of that. For example, insulin and glucagon produce different responses in liver. Because when you have one, you want the liver to do one thing, and when you have a lot of the other hormone, you want the liver to do something else. So the liver does the right thing, does different things in response to these two hormones. So let's sort of write that one down. So if you start with the liver, and you have two different hormones, like glucagon and insulin, you get different results. Now, on the other hand, if liver is exposed to either glucagon or epinephrine, you get the same response. You get the same result. Now, before we go any further, does this make any sense? Epinephrine is a stress hormone. In response to epinephrine, do you want to suck up glucose or release glucose? You obviously want to release glucose so you have the energy to deal with the pop quiz, run from the lion, etc. But why? So epinephrine allows you to release glucose in response to a crisis. Glucagon allows you to release glucose in response to normal in between meals, low levels. So both of these hormones do the same thing, but for different to achieve different purposes. One to deal with an episodic event that happens all the time, and one with a crisis. And it makes sense that they produce the same result. To take it one further, if you have liver versus, say, muscle, if you treat them with glucagon or epinephrine, you get different results. You don't get the same thing. We've already said, for example, that muscle does not respond to glucagon. It doesn't release glucose, but liver does. Similarly with epinephrine. What is the reason for all these differences? How do you explain it molecularly? Is it difference in receptors? Is it different in signaling pathways? Is it difference? What's the difference? Now, by now, you should know enough to be able to figure them all out. But maybe we'll do one of them. Let's just take this simple one. Why do you get a different response from these two? Same receptor? No. But what about here? Same receptor? No, this isn't the same receptor either. And yet, those are two different receptors, you get two different results. And this is two different receptors, but you get the same result. How is that possible? Same what? Same second messenger, but how do you get the same second messenger? It's true, in both of these you get cyclic AMP. But two different receptors, each bound their ligand, but you get the same second receptor. Second messenger, excuse me. So what does that mean? If you got cyclic AMP, what got stimulated? Must be adenyl cyclase. Who kicks in adenyl cyclase? A G protein. So these two, did they activate the same G protein or a different one? This must be converge at the level of the G protein. Two different receptors activate the same G protein, activate the same enzyme, get the same second messenger, you get the same result. But if you add glucagon to muscle, you don't get any results at all. Why is that? That is a very simple answer. There are no receptors. So this one, you don't get any response because there are no receptors for it. Liver has receptors for glucagon, muscle does not. But both of them have receptors for epinephrine. Yet you don't get their same response. Well, what he said is, you want the liver to release glucose and not the muscle. Now, that's what people call teleology, which is the rationale. But the question, which is correct, but the question is, what's the mechanism underlying that? What is it, why can muscle not pull off releasing glucose? What is it missing? It's missing an enzyme, phosphatase. So, in both of these cases, In both of these tissues, with epinephrine, you activate pKa. But the proteins to be phosphorylated and activated by pKa are different. So it's not that you don't have receptors. The same receptors in both cases, same signaling pathway, but different target proteins. So you get a different result. So we're going to meet, we've already met many, and we'll meet many more cases like this, where you get different results or overlapping results, and you can attribute it to the similarities and differences in receptors, G proteins, second messengers, etc. Yeah. She said, does the one for glucagon thinks about glucose levels?
Right.
You have to remember that none of these proteins think about anything. But you have a good point that what causes the release of glucagon is the levels of glucose in the blood. What causes the release of epinephrine is crises. So the sensors for these two are different. If you have high glucose in your blood already and you're exposed to stress, will you do release epinephrine? And whether you'll release more glucose is a good question. Possibly yes, but you have to remember that almost all of these loops are interconnected. So it's possible that one of these things inhibits the other. I don't know. So I want to go on now and change the subject a little bit. We have been talking here primarily about two specific hormones and how they maintain homeostasis in response to differences in eating and other factors. And what I want to do now is consider all the other major hormones, because we've been talking about two. What about all of them? And this is actually, we have two handouts today, A and B, that pretty much cover what I want to do. And we may or may not get to C today, which is some specific examples. And if we don't, we'll do that one next time, next Thursday. So I want to start with B, actually. Because what we have on B here are all of the major glands and the major hormones. Now, this doesn't have all the glands and it doesn't have all the hormones. And you'll meet others in your reading and in the problems. But these are the ones we're going to concentrate on for the next few days. Now, since we've been talking about glucagon and insulin so much, we're going to start by talking about the organ that produces them, which is the pancreas, which is actually way down here on the bottom right. And then we're going to talk about the adrenal, because these are sort of the two outliers. And then we'll go and look at all the rest, which are sort of interconnected. So the pancreas is a complex organ containing many different types of tissue. And it is both an exocrine and an endocrine organ. Now, you may or may not remember from the handout with all the kinds of signaling that endocrines are substances made by a gland, released into the blood, travel around, and hit their target. Exocrines are made in cells, glands that have ducts, as in tubes, not quack quack. And the exocrine secretions are made in the gland, travel through the duct, and go either to the outside of the body or illumine a space inside the body. Now, I think that it's clearer how they're set up if we look at an example, which is actually on B. And let me just say before we go that, of course, we've been talking about insulin and glucagon, which are endocrine secretions. But the pancreas also makes exocrine secretions from different set of cells. And these are enzymes that go into the lumen of the gut and help with digestion. But to make it clearer what's the difference between an exocrine and an endocrine gland, if you look at 21... Oh, I said it wrong. So it's on, that was B. So we need to go back to A. Both of these glands are formed from epithelia, which you may remember are sheaths of cells tightly connected. And these sheath during development, the epithelia fold in, as shown on your handout. And now there are two possibilities. What can happen is this bottom part can break off from the top. And that leaves you the top layer. And then underneath, you have the part that broke off, which would be like this part. And it seals, and it can either have a space in the middle, a lumen, or it can be solid. On the other hand, what can happen is when there is a looping in of the epithelial sheet, it stays that way. So then you get a situation that looks like this. Again, you have a gland in both cases, this one and this one. But the difference is that the gland on the bottom is not connected to anything. And so the secretions of this gland are going to go into the interstitial fluid, and from there they're going to go into the bloodstream, and then they're going to be carried around to their target. But what's going to happen to secretions made in the gland on the top? Those secretions are going to go into the lumen in the middle of the gland, and then they're going to go out the duct to whatever is on the other side. And that can be a lumen in the body, like the inside of the GI tract, or that can be the outside. If we're talking about enzymes that are going to end up in the GI tract, they would go and stay inside the body. But if we're talking, say, about a sweat gland or a tear gland or a mammary gland, then the secretion, milk, sweat, tears, goes outside of the body. So the one on the top is an exocrine gland, still has a duct, and the one on the bottom is an endocrine gland. Now, it should be clear from the picture, because this is a capillary, a blood vessel, that the raw materials for running the cell and for synthesizing whatever the secretion is come from the blood in both cases. But then when the special secretion is made, either the hormone or the milk or the tears, where it goes is different. So are there any other questions about this part? So the pancreas contains both exocrine glands and endocrine glands, and different parts of the endocrine gland, some make insulin, some make glucagon, and there are specialized cells that make other hormones that we're ignoring. And the question is, what's the input? As we've explained before, that what causes the production of insulin or glucagon is largely the level of glucose in the blood. So what you might call local input, the local conditions of the blood flowing over the pancreas, largely determines what the pancreas does. So this is the input. In addition, somebody asked last time whether the brain has any input. Yes, it has some. So there are nervous connections to the pancreas, which also can affect the secretion of these hormones. Now, we talked about the pancreas. What about the other gland that's written here? It's the adrenal medulla. So let's talk about that next. So you want to go back to B. Actually, I think I'm going to draw over here. Now, we've already talked about the adrenal medulla, but the adrenal is actually a two-part gland. So you could draw it this way. This is the medulla, or the part in the middle. This is the cortex, or the part on the outside. Now, there are many organs or structures that have a medulla, meaning a solid core, and a cortex, a level on the outside. So this is the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla. Now, these are really two separate glands, but are stuck together. And we're going to meet another example that's very similar. And these two halves, or two parts, actually develop from different kinds of tissue. The cortex develops from epithelial tissue. It's a standard gland, more or less the way we've discussed. But remember we said there are these things called neuroendocrines. That is, nervous tissue makes them, but instead of serving, the secretion doesn't serve as a neurotransmitter, it's secreted into the blood and acts like an endocrine. So the medulla is actually nervous tissue. Now, we explained earlier that the medulla is really part of the sympathetic nervous system. That you have, remember, in the autonomic nervous system, you have one neuron who has its body in the spinal cord in the central nervous system, and then it synapses outside. So you have a preganglionic cell and a postganglionic cell. And in most of the autonomic nervous system, the postganglionic cell has a long axon and contacts some target. But in the case of the medulla, the postganglionic cells have short axons and make up the medulla itself. So the medulla is like a ganglion composed of many neural cells, many postganglionic cells, and then the preganglionic cell from the nervous system synapses on it. So in this case, for the adrenal medulla, the input is neural. The message down the nerve to the adrenal medulla says, secrete your secretion and release it. And that secretion is epinephrine. Primarily epinephrine. Now, just for context, we have here this double gland. The middle part, the medulla, gets input for the nervous system and releases epinephrine. But the cortex on the outside is made of epithelial tissue, and it gets its input hormonally. It has receptors on its membrane, and it is controlled by ACTH. And we will explain what that is and where it comes from. So the cortex gets hormonal input, and it doesn't release epinephrine. It releases steroids. Epinephrine is water-soluble. Steroids are not. All of these, though, go through the blood to their target, bind to receptors in their target, and you get some action in the target cells. Exactly what the steroids are, we'll come back to. How they work, we'll come back to. Okay. So these are what you might call the two glands, though one of them's double, that are on the side, and everybody else is part of what is often called the hypothalamic pituitary axis. So, hypothalamic. And that's what we want to talk about for the remainder of the time. So, are there questions about this part before we go on? Yeah, just a second. Yeah? Go ahead, you. Yeah. So how does epinephrine get out? If you go back to this picture here of the gland, it's water-soluble. And it is released from the end of the neurons that make out the medulla. And I haven't drawn it here, but I suspect that there are capillaries in the medulla. And so it goes right into the capillary. I don't think it has to go through significant interstitial fluid, but it might be a little bit. So what we're saying is that in the medulla, there are cells that are releasing epinephrine from their nerve endings, and that's right near a capillary, and so the material is going into the capillary. Remember that epinephrine is a small molecule, and small molecules can get into capillaries in the spaces between the cells. And this is perhaps as good a time as any to discuss the structure of epinephrine and norepinephrine. In your notes, it's a little further down. It's in 3B, if you like to follow along. And on your handout, it's on 21A on the top. And we'll do it now, so we'll get this handout out of the way. Before we go on to the hypothalamic pituitary axis, we'll consider epinephrine and its relatives. We have mentioned many times that epinephrine and norepinephrine differ only in a single methyl. So here's where we finally get down to business and explain how they're made and what the real difference is. This has to go somewhere, and it fits well enough here. It turns out that there are relatively few small molecules that are used in signaling. Apparently, there aren't very many that work. And a bunch of them are derived from the amino acid tyrosine. So here we have tyrosine. And these are called, this group are called catecholamines, as written on the top. Now this is tyrosine, which is just a plain old amino acid. Now, dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine are all three closely related signaling molecules. Norepinephrine is primarily a neurotransmitter. Epinephrine is primarily a hormone, and dopamine is used for both. In the brain, it's largely a neurotransmitter, but it's also used as a hormone in the hypothalamic pituitary axis, as we will see. Now, what's the difference? If you take off this methyl and you add a hydroxyl over here, you can see that you get yourself dopamine. Of course, you have to put a hydrogen here. So that gets you dopamine. Now, to get from dopamine to norepinephrine, what do you have to do? All you have to do is take one of the hydrogens off and put an OH here. And now you have norepinephrine. And to convert it from norepinephrine to epinephrine, all you have to do is add a methyl. So all you've done is one of these hydrogens has been replaced by a methyl. Now the reasons these are called catecholamines is they are all amines, and this is catechol. Now you see that all these molecules are really quite similar. And basically, it takes one enzyme to convert each one into the next. So depending on what enzymes a tissue has, it can either make dopamine or norepinephrine and dopamine, or dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine. Most cells that secrete epinephrine secrete a little norepinephrine and vice versa. Now, all of these compounds, whether they're used as neurotransmitters or whether they're used as hormones, they all use G-protein-coupled receptors. But they differ in what enzyme is affected. Some of them affect adenyl cyclase, and some of them affect phospholipase C. So some of them affect the IP3 pathway, and some of them affect the cyclic AMP pathway. But the G protein can affect either the IP3 pathway or the cyclic AMP pathway. Now, I've written this in twice because some of them activate adenyl cyclase and increase the amount of cyclic AMP, and some of them inhibit adenyl cyclase and decrease the amount of cyclic AMP. So there's a bunch of different receptors here. The receptors for epinephrine and norepinephrine we've already met. Those are the adrenergic receptors. Epinephrine and norepinephrine are the same as adrenaline and noradrenaline. So their receptors are the adrenergic receptors. We talked about them already, alpha, beta, etc. Dopamine has its own receptors, They're similar but not the same. Just as there are multiple kinds of adrenergic receptors, there are multiple kinds of dopamine receptors. So what response you get out of a cell in response to a particular signal molecule depends on which receptors are present and which target proteins are available. Okay. So, yeah.
All these hormones that are listed here, the catecholamines, are considered peptide hormones?
Considered?
Peptide hormones?
No. Are these peptides?
No.
These are not peptides.
So are they bound on, so are there receptors in the cell or on the surface?
Well, are these things, the question is where are the receptors for these things? Are these things water soluble? And the answer is yes. So the receptors for all of these, remember I said they're G protein coupled receptors. These are all surface receptors. So these are, one of the things we did not discuss when we talked about hormones is that one way to classify hormones is by their chemical nature. Another is by their receptors, another is by their mode of action, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're not going into that, but at the end of the notes, all of those things are listed so you can try and classify them yourself. Many of the hormones are, and neurotransmitters, are modified amino acids. And they are almost all water soluble. Now, the only exception is that thyroid hormone is also made from tyrosine. But it's a very different compound. And it's iodinated. It has iodine stuck on it. And it's lipid soluble. So it acts in a very different way. And it has internal receptors. Thyroid hormone, in many ways, acts like a steroid. All the lipid-soluble hormones act in similar ways. And we'll come back to it. But all of these catecholamines are all water-soluble. Yeah?
Just your diagram, you're saying it's the same G protein that causes...
No, I should say that these are different G proteins. So each type of G protein-coupled receptor is hooked up, in this case... It's possible that two different receptors interact with the same G protein. But the point that we're making here is that the collection of G protein coupled receptors interacts with a collection of G proteins, and some of those G proteins promote the IP3 pathway, some inhibit the cyclic AMP, and some activate the cyclic AMP. Good point. Okay, so I want to come back now and look at the various hormones. Now, I realized that when I started to talk about hormones, I skipped a little something that's in the notes, which is the question of what the heck do the hormones do in the first place. And we've already got two of these up on the board. That hormones and other similar signaling molecules help you maintain homeostasis. They help you manage episodic events. And there are actually two more on the master list, which we might as well put in. One of them is to manage stress. Epinephrine is a big player there, but not the only one. And to control growth. When we talked about signal molecules, we said there were endocrines, exocrines, justicrines, neuroendocrines, et cetera, et cetera. And we also said there were paracrines. When people talk about hormones, they mean endocrines. They mean the same thing. It means made by a gland or a neural tissue, secreted into the blood, travel a long way, etc. The factors that control growth are also signaling molecules. Some of them act very much like hormones and are considered hormones, but some of them are classified differently as growth factors in that they stimulate growth and they are often paracrines instead of endocrines. But I've sort of thrown them in here because the signaling molecules that keep an organism coordinated control these four categories. Again, depending on whether you're a lumper or a splitter, you can come up with more or less. But these are usually the big four. So we've talked about the pancreatic hormones that control homeostasis of glucose and eating. The same hormone can control more than one of these. And we've talked about epinephrine a little, that controls the short-term response to stress. Cortisol, which is a steroid made by the adrenal cortex, cortisol is in charge of long-term response to stress. And in terms of growth, there are growth factors, and some of these hormones influence growth, and we'll come back to that. So what we want to do now, though, is go back and look at the so-called hypothalamic-pituitary axis. And for that, you want to go back to handout B, which has the big picture. Now, all of the hormones listed here are related to each other. They either come from the same glands or they control other glands. But you notice the hypothalamus is at the top. The hypothalamus, which has other names as well, which are mentioned in your notes for reference only, is in fact the integrative center for many different functions, and it is the top of this hierarchy, and it is actually part of the brain. Now, the hypothalamus gets input of three kinds. We've talked about hormonal input, we've talked about neural input, and we've talked about local input. And the hypothalamus gets all three. So some hormones from other places affect what it does. Nerves affect what it does from other parts of the brain and from back feeding from the body. And local conditions. So it contains sensors for certain, for example, for temperature, for body core temperature, which influences the messages that it sends out to other glands. Now, the hypothalamus then controls two other major glands, which are really part of the same thing. It controls the pituitary. Now, on your handout, we have written separately two different things. We have written the anterior pituitary and the posterior pituitary. Because the signal reaches them in different ways, and they release different secretions which have different effects, we've written them separately here. But they're actually together, just like the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla. And that follows from that little picture that's on the bottom left. Now, I'm not going to draw the whole picture now. I just want to draw the critical part of it. The down at the bottom here is the pituitary. And the pituitary actually has two parts, the anterior pituitary, which in the body is closer to the front, and the posterior pituitary. Now, just it's really connected. And in fact, it's connected to the hypothalamus. And if you want to see the real anatomy, you should look in Sadava or in a physiology book or just Google it on the web. Just as with the adrenal, these two halves develop, one from epithelial tissue and one from nervous tissue. So the posterior pituitary actually is nervous tissue, and it grows down from the brain. And the anterior pituitary is epithelial, and it grows up from the mouth. So these actually release quite different compounds, as we will see. And what we're going to do is look at them separately. We're going to look at what comes from the posterior pituitary, and then what comes from the anterior pituitary, and then we'll discuss how it got there. The hormones that are released from the posterior pituitary are actually released from axons that have their bodies in the hypothalamus, as we'll explain. And there are two major hormones here, as you can see on your handout, from the posterior pituitary. One is oxytocin, and one is vasopressin, also known as ADH. Now, these are both peptides. They're both short peptides, and they're homologous, meaning they have a common evolutionary origin. They come from duplications of the same gene, and the two peptides are extremely similar. And they both use G protein coupled receptors. Now, what do they do, and how did they get their names? We've actually met oxytocin before. Oxytocin is responsible for stimulating contractions, so in smooth muscle or similar things. So it causes contractions of breast material, which allows you to eject milk, and it causes contractions of the mammary of the uterus, which allows birth. On the other hand, vasopressin causes the contraction of the smooth muscle around your peripheral arterioles, and that's how it raises blood pressure. Vasopressin was discovered twice, and that's why it has two different names. It was discovered once because of its effect on blood pressure, and it was discovered once because of its effect on urination, because it's called antidiuretic hormone. I will never forget when I was an undergraduate, I took a course in biochemistry. It was taught by a very proper, natty professor in a bow tie. And he said, diuretic means to pee. Antidiuretic means not to pee. And the rest of the time, he was completely straight. But I didn't know any other word for it. So this is antidiuretic hormone, and it causes retention of water. And there, that both increases the blood pressure and reduces water loss. And it also constricts your blood, certain blood vessels, so in two ways it increases blood pressure. So that's how it got the name vasopressin. And ADH, because of the change in the volume of urine. Now, we will actually consider, when we get to the kidney, more about where vasopressin works and how it does its thing. But for now, this is all I want to say about these two. And I want to spend the rest of the time looking at the other half, which is the anterior pituitary. Now, you can sort of see from this handout that there's a three-stage operation here. The hypothalamus controls the anterior pituitary. So I'm going to write this on the side because I think it makes it a little clearer. And the anterior pituitary controls a bunch of glands down here, of which there are three, the adrenal cortex, the gonads, and the thyroid. So there are three sets of glands, and each one makes a hormone. And the hormone from the final set affects target organs. They actually do something. All the rest of this is the setup. So, for example, the adrenal cortex produces cortisol and other steroids. The gonads, as you know, in addition to their other functions, produce hormones such as testosterone, estrogen, and the thyroid produces thyroid hormone, and that causes its target cells, that causes the target cells to do many things, but in part to change their basal metabolic rate. So we should put that in. So thyroid hormone comes from here, steroids come from here, and additional sex steroids come from here. Now, we see what the final result is. The adrenal cortex makes steroids, so do the gonads, and the thyroid makes thyroid hormone. Now, remember we said that thyroid hormone is lipid-soluble. All three of these final hormones are lipid-soluble and act in a similar way. The first two really are steroids. Thyroid hormone is not a steroid, but it's lipid-soluble and has a similar mechanism of action. Now, what kicks these in? There's a hormone from the anterior pituitary for each of them. But what kicks the anterior pituitary in is hormones from the hypothalamus. So if we take it from the top, the hypothalamus releases what are called either releasing hormones, inhibiting hormones, releasing factors, or inhibitory factors, all of the above. So there's a releasing hormone, sometimes inhibitory, but usually it's usually has a positive effect, but some of them are inhibitory. And there are different cells in the anterior pituitary that respond respectively to the various hormone releasing factors. So some of them respond by releasing one hormone, which stimulates the adrenal cortex. Other cells respond by making the appropriate hormones actually to stimulate the gonad, and different cells respond to make stimulating hormone for the thyroid. Now, this set of hormones are called tropic hormones, which I think is written on your handout. These hormones are called tropic hormones because they stimulate another gland. They stimulate the growth of the target gland and cause it to make its appropriate hormone, which then finally stimulates the appropriate target organ and actually does something. So you get releasing factors, tropic hormones, and then lipid-soluble hormones. So we have here three stages of something, and then we have the final, should put the final hormone here, and then you have a target cell. Now, maybe we should do an example. There's one in your notes. We already talked about the adrenal cortex, and we said it was controlled by ACTH. So ACTH, then, in the general case, if we're talking about the adrenal cortex, the tropic hormone is ACTH, and the actual hormone would be one of the steroids. I'll come back to that in a minute. But let's take it from the top again. The hypothalamus causes the anterior pituitary to make ACTH. Now, what does ACTH stand for? Well, it has multiple names, and it's also called corticotropin and adrenocorticotropin to make it clear it's a tropic hormone. But it's also called adrenal cortex tropic hormone. That's how it got its full name, ACTH. The point is, this is a tropic hormone, a hormone that will stimulate the adrenal cortex to secrete its hormone. So, what causes it to be made? You have to have a releasing factor. In this case, it's called CRH. Now, it could be called ACTH releasing hormone, but it's usually called corticotropin releasing hormone. So you have the releasing hormone for the adrenal cortex stimulating hormone, then you have the adrenal cortex stimulating hormone, and then you have the actual hormones made by the adrenal cortex. And I should say just one more thing about these steroids. The adrenal cortex makes cortisol. It actually makes three categories of steroids. Cortisol affects stress. Then it also makes hormones that affect salt and water balance, such as aldosterone. Not aldosterone. Yes, okay. And then it makes some sex steroids. Most of your sex steroids come from the gonads, but men have some estrogen and women have some testosterone, and that comes from the adrenal cortex. Okay. I want to come back to and consider how the two parts of the pituitary are actually connected to the hypothalamus, and how the secretions from the two parts actually get where they're supposed to go. So you want to come back to this picture that we had over here. And one of the reasons we want to look at this is it introduces a piece of anatomy which is very important. That is portal circulation. So if we go back to our little picture here, here's the hypothalamus on the top. And here are the two parts of the pituitary on the bottom. Now, releasing factors are actually, remember the hypothalamus is neural tissue, so it has neurons. And some of these neurons secrete the releasing hormones, the releasing factors, and these go into the blood. That is, they're released, they go to the interstitial fluid, they go to the nearest capillary, and they're picked up by the blood. Now, these secretions need to reach the anterior pituitary. If you think about the circulation picture that we drew last time, we said you have the heart, and the right half goes to the lungs, and then circulation goes back, and then the left half goes to the body, and we said that the circulation goes in parallel through different organs. So the blood comes in, say, to the kidney, and the blood vessels branch into capillaries, then you have exchange, and then the capillaries gather up again the blood and send it back. Well, if we use this system, if I put these releasing factors into the general circulation, how would they get to the anterior pituitary? What would happen is the hormones would be released by the hypothalamus, and they would go into the general circulation and go all the way around again, and then come back and go to the anterior pituitary, by which time they would be incredibly diluted. So what happens instead is we have a shortcut. We have what is called a portal vessel. This is where you have a connection, essentially, between two capillary beds. So instead of this capillary joining the general circulation, it goes to the anterior pituitary and branches again. And then there is a capillary here, which goes to the general circulation. And of course, some comes in as well, as shown in your picture. So what this means is that the releasing hormones go directly through this portal vessel to the anterior pituitary. And therefore, very small amounts may have a very big effect, because you don't have to make enough hormone to fill up the general circulation. You just need enough to target the anterior pituitary. All the releasing factors, plus and minus, are peptides, with the exception of dopamine. Dopamine seems to be the prolactin inhibiting hormone, releasing factor. But they're all peptides except for dopamine. And they all use G-protein coupled receptors, dopamine included. They all do. I think that's right. I know the second stage does. Okay, now how do things get from the hypothalamus to the posterior? This one I'm not absolutely positive. So how do things get from the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary? Here we have neurons whose bodies are in the hypothalamus, but whose axons extend down to the posterior pituitary. So when we say hormones are released from the posterior pituitary, where are they really coming from? They're really coming from the hypothalamus. They're being made in the hypothalamus, packed into vesicles. The vesicles move down the axons, using kinesin, which goes to the corners. They're carried down to the end, and then they're released like a neurotransmitter normally is from the end of the neuron. Except instead of being neurotransmitters, these are hormones. And so oxytocin and vasopressin are released, therefore, into the general circulation. As shown in your handout. So let's see if I want to use any more. Now, maybe we should just say one more thing so we can finish up this handout and not have to deal with it again. That you notice when you look at the anterior pituitary on your handout that it makes another set of hormones, which we have called other hormones. So the anterior pituitary makes the tropic hormones, and it makes one other set of hormones, which I've called other. And this is a sort of collection. And the first two I want to talk about briefly. And that's it, and then we'll wrap it up. And these are growth hormone and prolactin. These are sometimes called pseudotropic hormones. Because like the tropic hormones, they stimulate some other tissue to make something. The prolactin stimulates mammary tissue to make milk. And growth hormone has many effects, but one of the things it does is to stimulate the liver to release a secretion, which is called an insulin-like growth factor. Now, growth hormone has direct effects on some tissues of stimulating growth, but most of its effects are due through getting the liver to make growth factor. Now, you notice that these two are sort of parallel to what tropic hormones do. That is, they cause another tissue to make another gland to make something. Except in this case, what is kicked in is not a traditional endocrine gland, but either the liver or the mammary gland, which is exocrine. But each of these is kicked in to make its secretion, just as each of these is kicked in to make its secretion. Now, we're going to stop here, and what we're going to do next Thursday is bring back the third handout, because what we're going to talk about is how it works for thyroid hormone, and how the whole system is regulated. Now, not all the details for the exam are up now. The answers to the recitation problems and last year's exam are not up, and I will put those up today.